Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I actually decided my best shot at survival is I will dive down. I'll do a surface dive, get as far below the surface as possible. I'll wait for the boat to pass over me, and that'll be fine. Which was a great plan, except that I just forgot I had a life jacket on. And at that point, I couldn't get the zippers. I mean, obviously, you know, I couldn't get the zippers off. And then there was that just awful moment of there's nothing I can do right now except, you know, just hope for the best.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Talent Takes Practice, a podcast looking at what it takes to make it to the top of your chosen field and how we can use this experience to help youngsters maximize their own talents, whatever those talents may be. Joining us today is someone who has had to overcome huge personal barriers in their life before maximizing their sporting talents to reach the very top of her chosen sport. Steph Reed is a Paralympic long jumper and sprinter who competes for Great Britain. Five-time world record holder, reigning world champion winning gold at London 2017 long jump, triple Paralympic medalist in the long jump. At the age of 15, Steph was involved in a serious boating accident. Her life was thankfully saved, but her right foot had to be amputated. Now, Roberto, great to see you again, mate. Don't know about you, I'm just fascinated to find out how she overcame losing a foot to become an elite Paralympic athlete in long jumping and sprinting.
Quite remarkable, inspirational. You know, Matthew, we've done some inspirational people on this podcast, but I feel Steph's story will be, you know, a remarkable one. For Steph to achieve what she's achieved, you know, is, as I say, humbling and inspirational. So I cannot wait, you know, to find out more about Steph.
We love to learn and learn with purpose. It's so empowering knowing we can do better, feel better, be better. So this year we're continuing to learn with purpose using The Great Courses Plus, and we want you to join us.
With The Great Courses Plus, you get unlimited streaming access to thousands of video courses on virtually anything that interests you. The Great Courses Plus has something for everyone, and it's all thoroughly vetted, fact-based information you can trust from some of the best professors and top experts in their fields. And when you download the Great Courses Plus app, you can watch or listen on any device, so you can learn anytime, anywhere.
What purpose waits for you? Sign up for the Great Courses Plus to find out. We have a special URL to use, thegreatcoursesplus.com/talent.
And how you been doing, mate? I haven't seen you for a couple of weeks. I know that we're pumping these out, but we're recording this during the time of the lockdown. And I just want to say, mate, I know we rib each other a lot, but the work you've been doing on trying to make sure that young people are allowed to play sport, you're pushing against the government, you know that it's got massive mental health and other benefits for youngsters. Just tell me, how have you been coping with that campaign, getting involved in the political argument?
Well, you know me, Matthew, I'm not as educated as you, but I've got certainly got a drive and a passion and a determination. And, you know, when I'm on something, I'm relentless, like I was on the pitch. And I just feel that, you know, when some nonsensical statements are going out, which are confusing, I like to get to the bottom of it. So obviously with the Welsh sport, the under-18s, I've been able to enable youngsters to play in Wales. And I, you know, and I have my campaign for grassroots youngsters, not just in football, but in all sports, for their mental and physical well-being is so important for them to play. Listen, we are in lockdown at the minute. Listen, I understand we're in a pandemic, you know, and people are losing their lives, which is horrific, and COVID's affected us all in one way or the, of another. You know, and my heart goes out to everybody who's lost lives.
Do you know, the thing that hit me hardest, I think you're on BBC Breakfast with Sally Nugent, who I really admire. And I was thinking, is it such a big deal for young people not to play organised sport? And then Kathy said, my wife said, what about that young boy or young girl in a tall tower block, no outside space? They play competitive football once a week. They get mentored by a coach who's really helping them with other things in their life. You know, that is a massive thing for young people to have to forego.
Yeah.
I wrote a column on this and I totally backed everything you said. It's a brilliant campaign. You're not getting paid.
No.
Look, you're not getting paid. You're doing it because you believe in it. And I just want to salute that.
You know, for the likes of you, me and Steph, who were successful in our chosen field. You know, if you're 15, 16 now with aspirations of being an elite sports person in your chosen sport, you're going to miss out of maybe a year. You know, already they've missed out on 6 months. So you might have 18 months missed out of doing the sport you love.
Brilliant, Rob. Thank you. And look, I know that Steph has joined us. Steph Reed is here. She's in the building. Steph, hi. Thanks for coming on our podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Hi, Steph. Did you hear that? Obviously, you know, grassroots. Did you hear me and Matthew speaking then? I'm sure you back what I was saying, or maybe not.
I think, you know, for kids in those really crucial stages of development, first year at university or doing their exams, or like you say, yeah, trying to get a scholarship. This must be incredibly difficult.
Mm, yeah.
And I know that when I'm stressed out, I sometimes just need to get out and run and do something really physical.
Yeah, totally agree, Steph. Totally agree. Listen, it's great to have you, Steph. Great to have you.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. Steph, take us back to your childhood. If we could start at the beginning and the early days of finding sport. What was it a big part of your life growing up?
You know, I don't even remember a time when I didn't love sport. As you can tell from my accent, it's a bit unusual. I was born to British parents. My dad's Scottish, my mum's English, but they both wanted to travel the world. So I was actually born in New Zealand, and we moved around a bit. But I actually have this really distinct memory of being in Hawaii as a 3-year-old and actually watching an Ironman. And just thinking, I want to do cool stuff like that. And that just always stuck. And so I grew up playing every sport possible at school and just loving both the physical challenge and the competitive challenge.
I mean, that kind of explains the accent. I've been, you know, I pause there because I'm trying. Rob, give me your announcement. That accent.
I thought it was my wife's uncle moved to Canada, Vancouver. And I picked up a Canadian accent. I don't know. I didn't think it was.
Oh, you're right.
Oh,
no. Robbie, you were spot on. So I guess I'll get to the rest of the story. So we ended up moving to Canada. I grew up in Toronto. So from the time I was about 4 or 5, and I went through university there, I then met my husband, who's also an athlete. He was from the French part of Canada, but when we got married, he was actually living in Dallas, Texas. Oh. So occasionally I will drop a, you know, hey y'all, and that throws people off quite a bit as well. But yeah, so spot on. I'm impressed with your ear, Rob.
So my wife's uncle lives in Vancouver, West Van.
Have you been?
No, I've never been.
Stunning.
Yeah, and her grandparents on her father's side moved to. They lived on the river, and they used to sit out on the terrace watching the boats go past the cruise ships. Yeah, there you go, Matthew. Yeah, see that, Matthew?
Yeah, love it. I've never been, and they say it's one of the best cities in the world, don't they? Can you not ski?
My sister lives there, and so in the same day, They've actually got a ski hill in the city. You could technically ski and surf on the same day.
I was gonna sign for Vancouver Whitecaps, Steph.
What's the Vancouver Whitecaps?
It's a football team. Yeah, it's a football team.
in
MLS.
Harsh.
So I was gonna sign for them, but I decided to do Strictly Come Dancing instead.
How was Strictly?
Oh, it was amazing, Steph, amazing. I was hopeless, but, you know, I got to week 10. Would you ever do it?
I would totally do it.
Oh, go on, Steph.
It looks awesome. But did you find, so in terms of the training, in terms of the physicality, what did you find harder, like training for your sport or training for dancing?
Training for dancing. You know, I lost a stone, Steph, in the period of, I think it was 12 weeks I was in. Yeah, I was.
Was that stress or was that fitness?
Both. The worry, Steph, was incredible. You know, every Saturday night when the music and you walk down the stairs, because you're at your comfort zone. You know, I never danced. And doing it in front of 11 million people on Saturday night, because there was moments. Listen, as athletes, we know you have to be, you know, your routine. You might have mental things you do before you compete. You know, on Strictly, it's just basically remembering the steps, and your mind would go blank, you know, as you were walking down the stairs. And when it would say Robbie Savage doing a cha cha cha, I'd say to my partner all on few occasions, I forgot. Actually, and Ola would say, listen, as soon as the music starts, follow me and you will do it. And because we'd done the routine, say 200, 250 times in that week, it was muscle memory. Do you know what I mean? Muscle memory. Wow. It just gets you through it. Quite incredible.
You know, when we did the pod with Fred, Rob, I had never watched Strictly before, but now my kids are crazy about it, Teddy and Evie, so we watch it every week. But the thing that strikes me is how motivated is there prize money for Strictly? People are absolutely passionate about getting through each round. Is there kind of like a win bonus?
I think your money gets increased if you get to Blackpool, the halfway stage, and if you win it, I think you do get a little bit more. But I got to Blackpool, so when you see people getting to Blackpool, Steph, it's like, yes. Yeah.
How did you find the performance side of it?
I couldn't do it. James Jordan, who was Ola's husband, he'd come and help me as well, and he would say, "Listen, you've got to sell it. You've got to buy." He was a bit shy. You've got to just go for it. Do you know what I mean? You've got to do the facial expressions. And the thing is, Steph, you know, me and you are famous enough to do it. Matthew would never get on it.
I was just going to ask Matthew, would you do it? Are you dancing?
Not famous enough.
My family would probably not watch if I was on. I think the viewing figures would go through the floor. No, would I do it? I'm a terrible dancer. So I tell you what, Rob, that would put me way out of my comfort zone. I think it'd be quite interesting psychologically to try and do something that is alien to you in front of such a big audience. Yeah.
Steph, for Strictly next year. This is where
can you put in a good word for me, Robbie?
Yes, Steph.
But Stephanie, we're supposed to be in. We're interviewing Rob about Strictly. Let us interview. Steph, I just wanted to ask about the accident, because. Could you just tell, for the listeners, what happened and what was the aftermath like for you? Not just in terms of what it meant physically, but what it meant for you mentally.
So I do visit a lot of schools, and this is what all the kids want to know. And they're usually surprised when I let them know. Actually, I remember everything about it, which is really weird. Not in a negative way, but I was just very alert. Essentially, I had gone up. There was a bank holiday weekend, and I had two really good friends, and one of them had a cottage on a lake, and so we had gone up and we'd had an absolutely awesome weekend, and my parents were coming to pick me up in a few hours, and so we thought, let's go out on the boat one more time and go tubing. And tubing is just so everyone knows what it is, it's where it's kind of like lazy water skiing is how I would describe it, but basically you attach a big rubber inner tube to the back of a speedboat. And you go flying across the river, and I had hit a wave and I fell off, and I could see the boat coming back, heading towards me, and which wasn't unusual because obviously they have to come and they pick you back up and you go again. But unfortunately, there had just been a miscommunication between the spotter and the driver didn't actually know that I was in the water. He didn't know I'd fallen off. He wasn't looking for me. And, I remember looking back at the boat and just realizing he's going way too fast. He doesn't see me. And it's kind of amazing how, you know, your instincts just take over and kick in. And I just remember assessing my options, very emotionless. I was a great swimmer. I swam in school, but, I thought, I don't have enough time. Obviously, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, Stephanie, you have got to miss those propellers. That is your number one priority. I knew I wouldn't have had enough time to swim to either side. I still would have gotten sucked in by the wake. And so I actually decided my best shot at survival is I will dive down. I'll do a surface dive, get as far below the surface as possible. I'll wait for the boat to pass over me, and that'll be fine. Which was a great plan, except that I just forgot I had a life jacket on. And at that point, I couldn't get the zippers. I mean, obviously, you know, I couldn't get the zippers off. And then there was that just awful moment of there's nothing I can do right now except, you know, just hope for the best. And so I remember the boat ran over me, and it's really difficult to describe what it was like. I just remember it being really dark, and I just remember it being like, you know, time just stood still. And it was just a bizarre thing as well, because, you know, you're in the water, you can't see anything, you can't hear anything. I didn't actually know which way was up, because it was just, I don't know why, it was just really dark. And at some point, I just remember thinking, I feel like I'm going to drown. I really need to get back up to the surface. Which actually, the life jacket was pretty helpful in that instance. So I eventually made it back up. And the weird thing was, my very first thought initially was, that was really close. Probably not going to mention this incident to my parents, because I actually didn't know anything was wrong. I had no idea at that point, and I don't know how to describe it other than there was, wow, you two both look horrified as I'm describing this.
The expression of fascination. I mean, this is really interesting.
I actually didn't know anything was wrong initially. And then there was this moment of, I didn't feel right, and I didn't know what was wrong. And I think that was a point where I just thought, do you know what, Stephanie, you better just check all of your limbs are in place, because that was just how I felt. Things weren't right. And that was the point when I realized, wow, this is really not good. I had, without getting too graphic, I thought I had been cut in half, just based on my initial assessment. Unfortunately, the propellers had caught my lower back, and I had quite a significant wound, a very dangerous wound there. And it had caught my right foot, and things were very serious. I think that's when it got really real. There was actually a lifeguard on the boat who came out and grabbed me, and I think I knew, looking at everyone else's face, like, my goodness, this is terrible. We're miles and miles away from a hospital. I knew enough to know I was in desperate need of a blood transfusion. Also knowing I was deep in shock and just couldn't snap out of it. But I think that was a moment that hit reality, being 15 and thinking you're going to die, and that just not having been on your radar, and to go from this amazing morning to, I don't think I'm going to actually survive this, was quite terrifying.
Steph, you know, you were saying that initially, even though the propeller had caught your back and clearly made it a deep wound and had caught your right foot, you said you didn't feel anything. You had to feel with your hands to ascertain the damage. Is that just adrenaline?
I think it probably was a combination of adrenaline, possibly just because of the water was a little bit cold, and also everything was just cut so deep and so completely that, you know, the nerve signals had gone quite quickly. So again, it wasn't, I wasn't in pain. I just didn't feel right. And that is really unnerving.
Wow. And then what happened in the aftermath? Obviously you got the transfusion, but as I understand it, it was touch and go for a while. What are your recollections? What are your memories of that period in the aftermath?
So some of the memories after that, that's where they get a bit shady. I was in and out of consciousness, but I do remember, we ended up going to a local clinic, and just a doctor there trying to do the best that he could. And I remember at one point, I was scared at this point that I was going to die. And I'm usually a really kind person, but I remember this guy, and at the end, the wound was just so big, he got out the duct tape. And I remember just being like, what are you doing? Did you even go to medical school? Like, surely you've got something better than this. So that memory sticks out. And then at some point, I did make it to the hospital and was just, I am fully aware of how lucky I was. It just so happened that they managed to bring in the best orthopedic surgeon in the country at the time. He came back from vacation, one, because they just decided, you know, she's young, she's fit, she actually has a really good chance to live. But the biggest problem was it was a wound on my back. It was so big and so deep. And you think about propellers, which are unbelievably dirty. They're really worried at that point about flesh-eating disease and just your body going septic. And so that was actually the big danger. Nobody really paid attention to the foot until they could deal with that.
And is that... Rob, sorry, mate.
No, go on. I'm just... Yeah, listen.
No, I was just going to say that once the medical, the various operations... had taken place, just describe how it was for you at the end of that process. You know, what abilities had you were you bereft of at that point, and what did it mean for you psychologically? Because I'm guessing, as someone who's so sporty, I mean, it would have had an effect on all aspects of your life, but just perhaps talk about that in particular.
It was absolutely devastating. It was a very weird position to be in. On the one hand, to be so thankful to still be alive, and yet just so angry, and just knowing. So at the time I was 15, and at that point I'd actually started playing rugby when I was about 13. And my goal at that point was I was going to be an international rugby superstar. That was what I wanted to do. And that summer... you know, it looked like things were going in the right direction. I had caught the eye of the national coaches. They thought I was still a little bit too small and just needed to mature physically before I could be brought in. But to have all of that just taken away in a moment, it just felt really, really unfair. And to the point where I just thought, if I can't do sport, I'm not sure that I want to experience life like this. That's how much it meant to me. But equally, the other really hard thing was, obviously neither of you have been 15-year-old girls, but, that is the point when, you know, you're going through all sorts of changes and developing in different ways and figuring out who you are and learning how to, accept your body and dealing with all the other media that tells you should be this way. Just so many things going on. And the other really difficult struggle was I don't like who I am anymore. I don't understand this tag of disability. I don't know what it means. I don't like looking in the mirror and seeing, you know, 3.5 limbs. That was also really tough psychologically.
Wow. Incredible, Steph. So when did you then, you know, in your recovery, start thinking, right, I'm going to be, you know, a sports person? When did that rehabilitation start in your mind? Because I remember, Steph, listen, you've lost your foot. You know, I broke my leg. You know, when I broke my leg playing football, I was out for 8 months. And for me, the mental side was, am I ever going to play again? Will I ever be the same again? Do you know what I mean? And I knew there was a recovery process. But from your point of view, at such a young age, when you've, as you've said, you've got 3.5 limbs, that mental aspiration to be a sports person, when did that start? Because that is quite incredible.
To be honest, I didn't think... it was possible. I guess, well, the process actually started 7 days after the accident. So I was miserable. I didn't want to see anybody. I wasn't eating. I just kind of checked out. And I will never forget, it was Monday morning, 7 days after, Nurse Claudette walked into my recovery room and she changed everything. She was... the first person who walked into that room and didn't feel sorry for me. And I think it almost took someone who didn't know me. And I think she could see, you know, she was an experienced nurse and she could see that I was checking out. I was kind of losing my will to fight. I just wasn't in this anymore. And she did the most unexpected thing in that she challenged me. And she basically said, you know, this is it. It's time to make a choice and you need to move forward. And she encouraged me and let me know that I wasn't alone. There was a young girl in the ward below me who was 10 and she had lost both of her feet. And Nurse Claudette said, you know, she's found a way to smile and so can you. And that was the turning point for me. I think she just, I mean, she probably was appealing to, you know, kind of that sporting instinct, that competitive instinct. And don't get me wrong, it's not that all the anger went, you know, that took years to deal with that. But that was a moment where I just knew, do you know what? This sucks. And this is not what I chose, but this is what I have. And regardless, I am going to make the best out of it. You know, at that point, I didn't really know anything about disability. I didn't know anything about disability sport, but I decided, I think it was a moment that I stopped feeling like a victim and it actually felt more like, okay, I'm starting a new chapter. Mm. And that was the difference.
How were your parents, Steph? Because, you know, I'm not relating this at all to your accident, you know, but when I got released from Manchester United at the age of 19, I was on the way home. You know, I was told by Sir Alex Ferguson I wasn't good enough to play for Manchester United. So as I was driving home, my mental thoughts were, am I going to tell mum and dad because I've let them down? And I had a car crash on the way home and I ended up in hospital with no feel in my left arm, you know, and the left hand side of my body. So lying in bed in the hospital bed the day I got released from Manchester United, you know, my biggest fear was telling mum and dad that I've been released from Manchester United. I've let them down for all the things they gave me. They took me to every match. They followed me around the country, as parents do. So my biggest fear was I'd let mum and dad down from my own personal perspective for all the sacrifices they made for me. And it was my dad said, listen, you're a fighter. You know, you can lie. When you're better, you can mope around. You've got to get on with it, son. You know, you've got to believe in yourself. You've got to come back. I know it's completely different from your situation, but how was mum and dad with you?
I think it was really hard for them. I think it was hard for a variety of reasons. One, because, I mean, by and large, the decision was made to amputate by the surgeon. I was unconscious. I wasn't involved in it. And I suspect, you know, that's super hard for a parent. And they're always going to wonder, oh, you know, did we make the right decision? And for them, I mean, I'm so pleased that they did. They did make the right decision. And as the surgeon explained it, they said, look, you know, we can essentially sew this foot up, but she's only ever going to have, you know, 30% function in it. She will never run again. Actually, if we amputate, she might have a shot to still play sports. So I think that was really tough on them as well. But I think what I probably wasn't prepared for, it was probably, I don't actually remember when, but at some point, you know, you get evaluated by a psychologist just to make sure that mentally you're doing okay. And I was really, the thing that she said to me that really threw me was, you need to be prepared for your parents, the possibility your parents might get divorced. And I was like, what a weird thing to say. On top of everything else that I'm going through. But I actually think, wow. And she was just explaining the reality is it's so hard for parents to, when they're mourning for children or for loss, if they mourn differently, it causes a lot of strain on the marriage. And unfortunately, she was right. My parents aren't together anymore. But I think I actually look back now and I just think it was good that, you know, she just said something that was quite hard to prepare me.
And you mentioned, Steph, that sense of identity, of who you are, of what you look like, of the person you're expecting to become. At that point, there had been some kind of a fracture and you were coming to terms with it in the days after the accident. Has that been an ongoing journey over a period of many, many years? I'd love to just understand how, I mean, one thing that strikes me, I don't know about you, Rob, Steph, as you tell the story, and it's obviously a compelling story, but you tell it with a, and listeners won't be able to see this, but you tell it with a smile on your face, almost as if you now regard that as a transformative moment for the person you now are, and you're comfortable with the person you are now. You're an inspirational person. And I'm fascinated about how that journey took place.
It was a long journey. It was a long, long road. And I think probably the reason I smile about it now is because I do look back and I mean, I hope people understand, it was tough. It was ugly. And it was very, very hard to deal with. But I look back and I just think in some ways, what a gift at 15 to be faced with this incredibly tough question, but to really have to decide for myself what makes life worth living, what makes me valuable still. And it was hard. I actually remember going back to school and still on crutches at the moment. And it sounds really silly, but, you know, just being worried, okay, well, my friends aren't going to like me anymore. My coaches won't like me anymore because I can't win games for them. I can't perform. And if I can't perform, then who am I? And I think that was probably the scariest question to answer. And there's no way to answer it other than to live through it. But I kind of had just made peace with the fact that, okay, life is going to look incredibly different. So just get rid of your expectations, show up every day and just kind of see what happens. And I remember, you know, after school, my mom worked full time. She worked late. And so normally I would spend, you know, the 2.5 hours between when school ended and she could pick me up playing sport. And I couldn't do that anymore. And so I would kind of just hang around and sit and watch sport. And it feels really silly saying this, but people would still come up and just chat with me. And, you know, we'd have a conversation. And it was just, I guess in some ways it was just, I didn't know people would still like me apart from what I could do, and realizing actually, yes, they do. And, you know, you're beyond this. That was huge for me. And I'm so thankful for that.
When you say, you know, you mentioned the word realizing there, Steph, when did you realize you had a talent for long jump? Did you pick a long jump or did long jump pick you? Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah. I think, do you know what? Long jump picked me. So it probably took me about another 4 years to get back into sport. At that point I had just, I mean, to be honest, I didn't know anything about Paralympics. This is 2000. This is before London 2012 happened. And I had just decided, okay, look, sport is not possible for you. And you know, my dad was basically like, look, you need to get a great education. That's now how you're going to succeed. So I put all that competitive energy into school and ended up with a full academic scholarship to study biochemistry. And I wanted to be a surgeon. That was my new goal. So I went to university, left sport and just thought, okay, you know, it was fun, but that's probably not for me anymore. And then I ended up in my first year at university, I had finally got my hands on a blade. And before when I ran, the times, you know, I enjoyed it, but the times weren't that impressive. And so I just thought, okay, well, that's cool. You're just not that great at it. But then I got a blade and I'm like, oh no, actually I am quite fast. Which made sense because I was always, you know, that was my skill on the rugby field. I was quick and I was agile. So I started off doing the 100, 200 and 400. And then I was at a meet one day and I had finished all my running events and there happened to be a spot open in the long jump. And someone said, well, hey, why don't you go on long jump? And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll give it a try. And I was good. And people were surprised, one, at how good I was, but they were also surprised that my natural instinct without thinking was to take off my blade. Which again, I was always right footed and it was my right foot that I lost. And that kind of, you know, set me on the path for, oh, well, maybe I'll be successful in this area.
Wow. And then from there you moved into representing Canada at first and then Great Britain in London 2012.
Yes. Yeah. That
must have been something else.
Oh my goodness. It was amazing. Yeah. One of the things people always ask me is, you know, why did you switch? And I think the truth is, so in my first, in 2008, I was still living in Canada. And to be honest, that was kind of the only option. And I actually came away with a surprise bronze medal. And it caught the eye of the British coach who knew I had a passport and he kind of headhunted me. And, you know, it's tough. I know it's really unusual and weird to have three passports and people always want to know, yeah, but what do you feel like the most? And I just think, I've always had these three. I don't even know how to answer that. But ultimately I knew that, look, London was hosting. This was the first time, you know, there was this huge commitment to the Paralympics. And, you know, I wasn't as young as I was at that point. I was 24. And I thought, look, I want to be the best in the world. I don't have time to waste. I want to work with the best. And that was what I would get at Great Britain. So for me, it was an easy choice. I wanted to be the best and work with the best.
Investing is one of the best ways to grow wealth over the long term. However, high commissions and clunky products from traditional stockbrokers can sometimes make it complicated for people to start investing.
Free Trade is on a mission to change that by breaking down these barriers and by opening up stock investing to everyone. While other brokers charge up to £12 for every trade, Free Trade doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can invest and keep more of your profits.
When you invest, your capital is at risk. The value of investments can go up as well as down, and you may receive back less than your original investment. Go to freetrade.io/talent, and if you register and fund your account, you'll get a randomly allocated free share worth between £3 and £200, such as Greggs, Rightmove, or Apple.
For more information, visit freetrade.io.
Steph, every person that we interview for the podcast, we ask three questions. And we're going to do the first one now. We have the second one a bit later and then the third one at the end. What was the weakest part of your skill that you had to work the hardest on to improve as a long jumper?
So for me, I think probably the weakest part is just raw power. No coach has ever looked at me and thought, wow, that is a physical unit. That's just not my gifting. I'm fast, I am agile, and I think actually probably my strength is that I can learn. I'm very coachable. I will pick stuff up really, really quickly. That is my advantage. So when it comes to power, I mean, it's just hard, especially something that is, you know, to an extent just genetically given. And so my task is like, I have got to maximize and make the most that I can of this.
I love that.
You're on a par with Matthew because he wasn't given a, look at his physical presence as well, Steph.
But don't you think, Rob, it's interesting that thing about, you know, certain gifts as a, in terms of power, and muscularity, you know, some people have an advantage genetically, but one thing we have control over is how well we learn, how well we listen, how well we take advice, the extent of to which we're prepared to practice. Steph, have you heard of this concept of growth mindset?
I have heard of it, yep.
Yeah, I think that sounds to me like a perfect description of a growth mindset, somebody who has learned how to learn well.
Yes, but equally, I think one of the hard things is I'm so aware of my struggles with power. My coach has actually called me out on it in the past. He's like, I can see, for example, when we do runs with sleds, he's like, I can see even just your physical shape change because you're aware people are looking at you and you're aware that you're not good at it and you don't like it and you just need to get over it. And that is exactly the growth mindset, being willing to step into those places that you're not good and get better at it. So it has still been a struggle for me.
See, Steph, Matthew has wrote numerous books. The 10,000 Hours with Bounce, Matthew, is that one?
Yep.
Have you read that, Steph?
I have, actually.
Please don't say that, Steph.
Rob's gutted. Gutted. That's like the worst news he's had in months.
Listen, and please, both of you, correct me if I'm talking nonsense here, but that mindset there of bounce for 10,000 hours with long jump, you said long jump picked you. Do you think that with a new sport to you, and obviously, you know, do you think that is right, that if you can do something for 10,000 hours, you can become an expert in that field? Or do you think you need a little bit of talent in that field? Because you must have had a little bit of talent for long jump.
No, I don't think 10,000 hours is a guarantee you're going to do something well. I think there's two things you need. Well, I don't think that's what you intended either, Matt, when you wrote it. I read a little bit about it as well.
No, it isn't. Rob, yeah. Every single podcast, Rob sets up this complete straw man. And then whoever we're interviewing says, no, I don't believe in that. And then he goes, told you, Matthew, told you.
But no, I don't think Matthew meant that either. So what I think is that, okay, if you want to be great at something, you do have, there's like a base level of talent that you have to have. And if you don't have that, okay, you know, let's face it, I'm never going to play in the NBA. It's no matter how much I do, I don't have that base talent. And then I think once you have that base talent, that's great. But that's then 10,000 hours of, you know, what I would call intentional practice. And whether or not it's 10,000 exactly, I've got no idea. But I do think, you know, I've definitely noticed in my career, which would have started in 2006, so I'm coming up to about 14 years now, there's been these different like trajectories of learning. So I learned a ton in the first 2 or 3 years. And then I feel like, you know, to an extent, you then spend this middle part of your career wishing I was back at the beginning and being that naive person without the pressure and the stress and, how do I do all this? And then you get to the end of your career and it's almost like, okay, now I can use the physical ability and the experience and I know how to do this mental game. So I've almost got the best of both worlds, just the total naivety of when I first started combined with all that expertise. And so, yeah, I think it's just this, it's a combination of showing up every day, but also being intentional and having a plan and sticking with that. There have been times, and I'll never forget. So after London 2012, I remember I won a silver medal jumping a PB, and I was totally thinking, yes, I've made it. Like, my career from now on is going to be super easy. Totally nailed this. And then in 2013, the next year, showing up to World Championships, totally thinking I was going to win and finishing last. And that was because I was coasting on what I thought I had done in 2012 and hadn't done anything new or intentional, and everyone else had. And that was tough, and that was a wake-up call. And, you know, that was kind of the kick in the butt I needed the next year, 2014, when I broke my first world record. And, you know,
five world records.
All in that year, yeah. And it's a painful lesson. It is not fun, but you know, there's just, you don't really get that coasting year, do you?
Do you think, you talked about intentional practice. I think that's a really good phrase, that it's not just going through the motions. It's not turning up and, you know, in my case, hitting a few backhands and forehands. It's being completely committed to what one's doing, challenging oneself, trying to be stretched, really giving one's whole being to the practice. And I think that's difficult to do week in, week out for a lot of people. I think it's particularly difficult, Steph, and it'd be interesting to hear what you have to say here. When you've achieved so much, retaining that appetite to continue to push yourself, have you found that difficult?
Do you know what? I've not yet, because I feel like, yes, I've been doing this now for quite a long time, but I still couldn't say that I have experienced that perfect jump where everything just happens and it flows and it's easy and it's fun. And I just imagine, okay, maybe at some point they'll, you know, I will step out of the pit and I'll kind of look back and look at my coach and we'll just know, do you know what? That was you maxing out on your potential. So far every year, there's been something new that I've wanted to work on. I've had a new idea. I've had a new idea about how to improve. For the moment, I'm still quite involved and I love training and I love competing and that hasn't gone yet. At some point it will. And I want to move on and find a new challenge, but I haven't hit it yet.
You love competing. How competitive are you with your husband? You know, for people who don't know, Steph, wheelchair racer, he won the London 2020 marathon, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
How competitive are you two?
Well, I mean, for us, we just think it's quite normal. And I think, so it's not necessarily about, I am really competitive, but I do just like to qualify. It doesn't mean that I have this agenda where I want to come and like dominate every person, but I very, very much want to do my best. And I get really angry when that doesn't happen. I remember a few, it must have been a few years ago, Brent and I were visiting my mum in Canada and we went to a movie. And so we decided we were going to play a game of air hockey. And wow, that got intense. And I remember at some point looking up and my mum just being horrified, like, how can you both go at it like that? But for us, you know, we walked away and it was fine.
Wait, air hockey, you mean that thing where you get the little kind of like tokens?
Yes.
And you've got air coming through. I've got
it's a bit better sport than table tennis, air hockey.
You know, we've probably got 25% of our listeners are table tennis enthusiasts. So they're here and then you slated it. it is probably better. But on my first, well, not my first date, maybe my second or third date with Kathy, we played it in the Trocadero, Piccadilly. They had some of these tables. Honestly, because you can hit them so hard that they leave the table. And we were whacking. It's almost, you know, flying into each other's faces. So I love that image of the two of you going hell for leather.
Oh, we were. I mean,
does the relationship work despite that competitiveness?
I think it works almost because of it. Right. You know, one of, in many ways, Brent and I are both, we're complete opposites. I'm someone who tends to, I have huge emotional highs and, you know, big lows, and I love them both because it's really fun. Whereas Brent is, you know, super just stable and steadfast. My job at Side of Athletics is as a broadcaster. That is Brent's worst nightmare. He's a software engineer and would love nothing more than just to race and go home and not, you know, have to speak to anybody, because for him, the joy is just, it's in the racing. But I think the thing about being married to an athlete is just that level of accountability and the standard that we both hold each other to, and the way that, you know, we both challenge each other. And I just think, I just love being married to Brent, because I just feel like I would be bored. You know, he's harsh sometimes, and sometimes it hurts. And, you know, I've gone to him asking, making the mistake of, you know, hey, babe, what do you think about that long jump? Totally expecting, I love you and you were amazing. And him actually analyzing it, and I'm like, what are you doing? But I have to just separate. You know, that is just the standard we hold each other to, and I love it.
Steph, what was more nerve-wracking? You know, I've mentioned about being on Strictly. You were on the catwalk, weren't you, at London Fashions. What was more nerve-wracking, standing of that jump for, you know, in an Olympics or on the catwalk?
Oh my goodness, Rob, I was so nervous. So I showed up that day. Okay, and so not only was it a catwalk, so it was this incredible experience where one of the designers collaborated with an artist called Sophia, who runs a project called the Alternative Limb Project. And so basically what she's doing is, instead of making limbs, artificial legs or arms, you know, these kind of awkward things that people, oh, should I stare at it? Should I not? She transforms them. They are meant to be stared at, and they look amazing. So she actually made for me this incredible chandelier high heel stiletto leg out of one of my running blades.
Wow.
So this was not just a case about, okay, so one, okay, I needed to make it down the runway in stilettos on a really, really unstable leg that was designed to run, not to walk. That was the first challenge. But the second challenge was, this is London Fashion Week. Wow. You cannot just teeter down. You need to go with attitude. So yes, I was terrified, but the other models were so lovely, and they took me aside and gave me the best crash course in how to walk a runway. And it was fantastic.
Wow.
That's fantastic. Let me throw in the second question, the second set question. What is the one thing you've got no talent in at all, but wish you had?
Well, actually, do you know what? Until about 6 months ago, I would have said singing. Okay, so if I couldn't do what I wanted to do, I would have been on Broadway. I would beg my parents to take me to auditions. The problem was, I couldn't sing very well. And just, you know, this was professionally confirmed at 12, and that was rough. But I just love singing, and in lockdown, you know, everyone was kind of, this is the first one, everyone was kind of talking about, oh, what new skill are you learning? I thought, you know what, I'm going to take singing lessons. And I had the most amazing teacher, Layla, and we did them on Skype, which wasn't ideal. But the thing is, I had thought for years I was tone deaf. I wasn't tone deaf. All I had was an underdeveloped voice box. And I'm not going to say I'm awesome, but I've definitely improved. And I think, again, it was just this, you know, reminder that, okay, I'm never going to be an amazing singer, but I can carry a tune. And if you actually just work towards things, you probably have more potential than you think. And so I think that just, again, was this huge encouragement. You've got to try, and not just try once, you know, give it at least a month, and then you can decide if you're good or not.
Yeah,
and no, I'm not going to sing for you right now.
Steph, you were talking about, I think it was 7 days after, when was it the nurse that walked in to you and was an inspiration? You know, when you see youngsters now with, you know, who have had such unfortunate accidents and have, you know, have amputees, are you their inspiration now? When you walk into that room, have you got the same attitude as that nurse had with you?
I hope so. I think it's, people will contact, and it's so tough because It's so hard to know what to say to someone who's going through that moment when you don't really know them. And you have to be honest. And the truth is, what is possible for people, you know, can be very different depending on what the accident is. Mm. And I think what I've learned is probably the hardest thing for me during the accident was being given false promises and false expectations that weren't true. And so I think if anything, I want to toe the line that Nurse Claudette did. And that is basically, you know, we look at reality. We don't sugarcoat it. We don't pretend things are easy when they're not. Yeah. And I have to be honest with them. I know, yes, okay, fine. This is 20 years removed. I've dealt with a lot of things, but that first year was ugly and tough. And I can't say anything. I can't say anything other than that to someone. But the key is, and what I did learn is that, you know, we can do tough things and we can get through it. And if nothing else, I think what Nurse Claudette left me with was this idea that I could have lost every limb on my body and I still would have been the same person. You know, I was still me. I was still competitive. I was still wanted to explore and have fun and do new things. And that didn't change. It was just the manner in which I then did it was now going to be different.
Does Nurse Claudette know how significant that is? Have you managed to tell her what that conversation has meant to you?
Do you know what? I'm not sure that she does. I didn't actually see her after that. I went back to the hospital for different clinics and follow-up visits, and unfortunately, I never saw her again. But I just think she was someone who has been with hundreds and hundreds of people in some of the most difficult times of their life. I imagine right. She sat with parents, with children, and to have someone like that at that moment, I mean, it was transformative for me.
So it's now 2 decades, isn't it, since your accident, over 2 decades. What looking back on it, what would you say to your 15-year-old self? What would be the advice if you had that opportunity to talk? I mean, obviously, it really hit me powerfully. I think it's very wise what you said about not sugarcoating reality, not building false expectations. I think that is true not just of a traumatic incident, but almost anything in life. I think we shouldn't condescend to young people and try and sell them fairy tales that aren't real. And I think they see through that in the end. But what else would you say to your 15-year-old self?
Do you know what the funny thing is? I actually, I always think of that question on the reverse. There are so many things about 15-year-old me that I wish I still had and that I loved. And sometimes as you grow up and you become an adult and you have new experiences and some things leave you just a little bit, you learn a little bit more. Sometimes, you know, you see some of the uglier things of the world and that's hard. But what I remember about that 15-year-old girl is, and what one of the best parts of it was the way that I kind of wrapped my head around it was that, in a sense, I had now checked out of all expectations of society. I didn't fit the mold. I was fully aware of it. And that just left me with this incredible freedom. You know, people's expectations, not in a negative way, but were low. People didn't expect me to go back to school and want to excel or expect me to want to, you know, do sport. I remember probably, it must have been about a year and a half after the accident, I was invited to, some friends were having a skating party. You know, back in Canada, it was quite common to build a skating rink in your backyard. And I showed up with my skates and I got there and nobody else had their skates. And I was just like, did I get this wrong? Like, was this not a skating party? And as it transpired, when they found out that I was coming, they didn't want to skate in case I couldn't skate and make me feel bad. Which was lovely. But again, it was just this idea that with every single expectation removed from me, I was in complete control to explore and try new things and fail and not care. And it was awesome. I think that was what let me, you know, pursue an academic career. And part of that was just, I became this person that was never embarrassed to ask questions. I wanted to know everything. I didn't care how stupid I looked. Either way, I was walking away, you know, knowing more. When I was in high school, I still had that competitive drive and didn't really know how to get rid of it. And in the end, I signed up for the debate team, which was amazing and loved it. So I actually think there were a lot of lessons that 15-year-old me needs to remind me of now.
Steph, you know, listening to you speak and people who are listening to this podcast, as Matthew's alluded to, won't be able to see your face. You haven't stopped smiling throughout this interview. It's quite incredible and inspirational. So inspirational. But I alluded to the fact that I broke my leg, I broke my tibia, and there's still a little bit of resentment in me every day, you know, when it gets cold and my leg's sore. I can only play for 20 minutes, you know, in a game of football now because my leg swells up. So there will still be a bit of anger and resentment in me from, you know, from the person who broke my leg. It wasn't intentional, it was an accident, but still, if that, I still think sometimes, if that hadn't have happened and I'd have broke my leg, could I have done better in the latter stage of my career? So there is still a little bit of anger or resentment in me. Is that, have you got any anger or resentment at all in your body?
The honest answer is no. So the accident, it was quite a tough situation in that the person driving the boat was the brother of my best friend. And, you know, I had known him, he had known me, he was a few years older than me. He'd been the person that, you know, would look out for me. We went to the same school. And I knew it was an accident. That's exactly what it was. And if anything else, it was far, far more difficult for him. And actually, the interesting thing is, in the aftermath of the accident, we both became runners. Me getting my blade, but for him, it was just the only way to deal with the guilt. And I actually felt it was just so hard to watch because I felt like I had so much support and care for me, and everybody was just so angry at him. And it was just so unintentional. And I actually remember about 5 years after the accident, we're not in touch now. I think it probably is still a bit painful for him in terms of just seeing me. But I did go to visit him, and I knew that he'd been struggling, and I just wanted to let him know and to see me and just know I'm okay. Wow. You know, you can, like, I just want to release you from this. And that was quite a powerful moment for me and hopefully for him.
Wow. Steph, the final question I don't think we need to ask, because I think Nurse Claudette is probably going to be the person. Because the question is, what's the best piece of advice anyone has ever given you, and who said it? Are we right in nominating at this point Nurse Claudette? If you're still with us 20 plus years on, if this is getting out to where you're listening, please get in touch on Twitter. If anyone knows a Nurse Claudette, what was the name of the hospital?
It was Sunnybrook Hospital in Toronto.
Can I just say, Steph, I've done so many podcasts with Matthew. We've done some emotional ones. But I've got to say, Matthew, your eyes all the way through have been bloodshot. I think it's really touchy, this podcast, isn't it?
Oh, it's been...
Very emotional, Matthew.
Rob, I'm sure you agree. Yeah, I think Steph's one of the... Look, I know you do speaking and broadcasting, but I think you're... And I don't want to embarrass you, but you're just such a brilliant talker. And there's such an incredible depth in everything that you say. And it's been amazing. It's a real contrast with Rob, because he's so shallow. I mean, it's like, it's almost...
We had to pause.
That is a horrible thing to say. But there's a wonderful, it's like the yin and yang of podcasting. We got Steph and we got Roberto. And
we had to start this podcast late because my gates wouldn't close.
But it's been brilliant. It's been absolutely brilliant. Do you enjoy doing the motivational speaking, Steph?
Do you know what? Yes and no, which I'll clarify. I absolutely love it. I mean, I just think, as an athlete, and Robbie, as you'll know, we are so fortunate and that we get so much investment in us in terms
Won't I know that too?
Why
is it only you and Rob? Rob, you know as an ex-sports person. That other guy, he has no coordination. He doesn't understand.
I mean, you might have in your career. I'm not a writer. But we get quite a lot invested in us in terms of performance and just kind of managing emotions and how to deal with tough situations, because competing is tough. Competing on a world stage is tough. Dealing with pressure is tough. And so one of the best moments of my life actually was about a year and a half ago when we were doing a promo event, and a little girl who was 11 came up to me afterwards, and we had done some running with the school, and she said, "I love running. I get so nervous. I don't know what to do. How do I control my nerves?" And just the way she asked it, you could see she was so desperate to be involved in sport, but just couldn't get over these nerves. And I just said to her, honestly, I never found a way to deal with them either. But what I learned was that the nerves were there to make me feel better. And when I feel them and my stomach starts feeling a bit funny, I just say, welcome, guys, let's do this. And her face just lit up. And so, yes, I absolutely love getting on a stage and speaking to people. I think the one thing that I don't enjoy about it is I just don't think you're ever going to change a person's life in one interaction. Speaking from a stage does not have the same impact as, you know, weekly or monthly input. And I think that's probably my preference in terms of really, really watching someone's life change and grow.
Steph, I don't want to embarrass you here, but this is quite funny. I've got to pick you up on the... Steph, this is one of the greatest podcasts of my life because I didn't know Matthew played table tennis either. He actually played in the Olympics. Yeah, I'm on, Steph.
I do. You know, Rob, I could, you know, in the corner of my...
Oh, no. There's no coming back from that.
Well done, Steph. My favourite podcast of all time. He won the Commonwealth gold, Steph. You're just the writer.
Oh, but honestly, I could see in the corner of my eye, I could see your face lighting up. And you wanted to interrupt and say, that is a genius way to end this. A genius way.
Tell Steph. So Steph, obviously, you know, Matthew is now known for, you know, writing, a fantastic writer, but he actually did play table tennis, Steph, and he played in the Olympics, didn't you, Matthew?
I'm incredibly jealous because actually that's an incredible transition to go from, you know, elite sport to elite in terms of, you know, writing and performance. So I'm impressed.
Yeah, it's too late. It's too late.
I didn't know.
Great try.
I mean, that's sincerely.
but you're right. It was a great.
No, Matthew, on a serious note, Matthew, just tell Steph quickly about your journey. We can edit this out of the podcast, but just tell Steph quickly of your journey because it's quite an amazing one, Steph.
Yeah, so.
Seriously.
Yeah, I started playing table tennis at school, became British number one, 10 years at number one in Britain, 3 Commonwealth golds, 2 Olympic Games, retired at about... it makes it sound like I'm trying to justify myself here. I can see, for people not, I can see Robbie's face like dominating the Zoom screen now with a huge grin. I loved playing table tennis. And, you know, I think like you, Rob, I still miss it a lot. But being able to write about sport and interview, it, you know, fascinating sports people, and you would be near the... Well, you used to be near the top of that list. Now you're very near the bottom 10%. It's gone way down. In all seriousness, Rob, thanks
for bringing it in.
I've just got to say, Steph,
honestly...
Yeah.
For me, this is one of the best podcasts I've done. Such an inspirational person, Steph. Honestly, as I've said, I've had ups and downs in my career, you know, and that we do now as broadcasters, you know, and I never went through what you went through, you know, broken leg, I broke my neck, you know, but for what you went through, for you to be as happy, to be as successful as you are, honestly, Steph, I'm humbled to have done this podcast with you, honestly, and I really mean that from the bottom of my heart. Fantastic.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, and let me echo that, Steph. And let's stay in touch. I'd love to meet you. I'd love to meet your husband.
He wants a game of table tennis against Steph.
And have a game of ping pong. I want to take you down at table. Forget air hockey. I want to take you down at table tennis.
We can do both. And Rob, I actually love table tennis. I'm not great, but love it.
Well, no, it was Matthew.
Yeah, probably beat me. But listen, thank you so much, Steph.
Joe, I really, really enjoyed that. That was really fun. Apart from my massive foot in my mouth moment.
Thank you to everyone for listening. Please remember to rate and review us wherever you get your podcast. Do spread the word about this pod, Talent Takes Practice. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, from all of us, goodbye.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.